Yeah, thank you for the very nice introduction. So yeah, today I'm going to tell you about some of my recent work with the Bandren and on diamagnetic response and phase stiffness. So I don't have a lot of to cover. Feel free to interrupt me with questions and comments. So this, yeah, as Yingchen said, this is material related. So part of this work is motivated by the discovery of superconductivity in marine materials. So ever since the first discovery of superconductivity by Pablo's group in 2018, people have discovered various superconducting state in many Moray systems, such as just a bibliographing or like other graphene-based Moray materials. But there, so if we think about a common feature of these kind of system, we almost like often find ourselves dealing with such scenario. Which is that for this Moray system at low energy, there are some active bands which have a separation between fully filled remote bands and fully empty remote bands with a large band gap. And the energy scale of the problem that we're interested in is that although there, so this, for us, this partially filled active band is strongly interacting. The Coulomb, for example, the Coulomb interaction between the electrons can be comparable to the bare bandwidth, but the larger scale, but they are all much smaller than the gap band gap separating the active bands with other remote bands. And so a natural question to ask is that suppose we would like to calculate some physical quantities for the superconductor, such as superfluid stiffness, which characterize the phase coherence in the superconductor. Like how should what's a general formalism for addressing such questions? So there are some attempts. For example, there are some attempts using mean field theory in these papers. And recently people also proposed some exactly soluble models where the superconducting ground state can be written exactly. There are still some challenges. First, we are dealing with a strong coupling regime. So a priori, we cannot justify the BCS mean field theory. And even if we can apply, we can solve these exactly soluble models, this is fine-tuned, it's not some general formalism. So in this talk, I'll try to address this question. But maybe before that, we can ask even more general question, which is the effective response. So say I give you such narrow band systems with strong interaction, and now you want to calculate, for example, some properties of the superconductor, which can be related to the response function to external electromagnetic field. And then the natural question is to ask how to couple this effective theory to a probe gauge field. Why am I emphasizing this effective theory? Because in these systems, of course, at low energy, we're only dealing with a very narrow band. And there are, for example, hundreds band deep down and hundreds band up above. And it's not very economic to consider all the bands. Of course, we can include them, but it's not a very efficient way. If you say you want to do the calculation either analytically or numerically. But why is this a non-trivial question, right? Conventionally, what we do, we perform power substitution for a time binding model. But oftentimes in these Moray materials, the low energy degrees of freedom form topological bands. So there is no real space tight binding model to begin with. But moreover, even say a Chen band. Yeah, but even for trivial bands, there's still some ambiguity because the definition of the 1-year orbitals has some gauge ambiguity. This is due to the fact that if we have a Bloch wave function, we can always multiply it by an arbitrary phase. So this gauge ambiguity will result in the time binding model that we can written down, that we can write down. So different gauge choices will give us different time binding model. But if we want to calculate any physical quantity, that those should be gauge independent. So in this work, I'll tell you how to obtain the effective gauge coupling in the long wavelength static limit without relying on time binding Hamiltonians. So here is the outline of my talk. I first give you some backgrounds and introduce how to write the superfluid stiffness in terms of response functions. Then we can do a very simple example, but that will address some of the ambiguities that I mentioned. And then I'll present our results and apply it to various systems. The superfluid stiffness, it can be related to a transverse current response in the following way. So this superfluid stiffness ds can be written as a summation of two terms. One is a diamagnetic term, which is this guy, and the other one is a current correlator, but taken in this specific limit. So this, for example, if we calculate the current correlator, the JX current correlator, we want to take the limit where we take the static limit and the QX goes to zero, 2X equals to zero limit, and let the transverse wave vector approach in zero. So, and this formula is directly related. This is pointed out in this paper, and this formula is obtained from considering the Meissner effect of the superconductor and relate the penetration depth to the superfluid stiffness. So another thing is that for 2D BKT transition, the superfluid stiffness is proportional to the transition temperature with some constant. But say if we're interested in an upper bound of the superconducting temperature in 2+1D, since this current correlator is always greater or equal than zero, then this superfluid stiffness is actually bounded by this diamagnetic term. So yeah, and let me tell you more about this this diamagnetic term. So for Galilean invariant system, this guy is actually proportional to the charge density over electron mass. By electron mass, this is the bare electron mass. But Immediately, one can see that this is not a very useful bond, although it is a bond. The reason is that at low energy, the effective mass of the band that we're interested in is much greater than the band, usually is much greater than the bare electron mass. So this energy scale is actually much larger than the energy scale that we're interested in. So for example, this is like an EV energy scale, but the low energy physics all happen at milli EV. But on the other hand, since the band gap is very large, so I think intuitively we should expect that such effective formula will hold. What do I mean by effectively? So this effective, we can expect that the superfluid stiffness of our theory, of the system that we're interested in, can be written as some effective diamagnetic response and some effective current correlator. By effective, I mean these quantities should only evolve the degrees of freedom at low energy, which is the charge degree of freedom of the partially filled narrow bands. So
in the superfluid phase, I suppose this ds should be a finite value, but in the other, like say,
right, that's a good question.
It's zero.
Right, it's zero. For example, for example, for a band metal, right, this will just be zero. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're not considering a strongly interacting theory, for example, if you just consider free theory, these can all be calculated, and you can see it's zero immediately.
So is the k bigger in the superfluid phase, or the, like, why the difference?
Oh, right. That's a good question. So, for example, in BCS mean field theory, you still obtain you have some finite k, which is exactly like this one, but then this current correlator vanishes because there's a energy gap. Mm-hmm. So the second term vanishes. That's why you get a finite. A finite DS, but I should say something more. So this limit is important. If you switch QX with QY, say you take QY equals to zero and QX approaching zero, then you get Drude the weight. So yeah.
So for example, the ds should vanish, I think, in the normal metal phase, is that correct?
Right.
Can I say that the k effective changes smoothly when you go from a superconducting phase to a normal metal phase, but the k second term change drastically.
Yeah.
Metal phase transition.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So, I think we should expect that we can write the superfluid stiffness only in terms of the degree of freedom of the effective theory with some correction that's suppressed by 1/2 band gap.
Oh, sorry, another question. So if I change the order of limit, for example, I first take a q to zero.
Yeah.
Then I should have some Joule weight from the formula, right?
Yeah. So if you take q, So if you take q goes to, So if you take q equal to zero and omega approaching zero, you get Joule the weight.
So the second term gives you Joule weight, right? The first term.
No. The you the summation of these two terms give you the Joule de Witt.
So both of them contribute to Joule de Witt.
Yeah, yes. Yes. Right, and there's another limit that you can take, which is switch these two, and then you should always get zero because of the gauge invariance of the theory. So, yes, so next I want to, so next we can ask how to get the effective response functions. Roughly speaking, there are two approaches. The first approach is that we can start from a UV Hamiltonian, which includes all the remote bands, coupled to a, and then we couple the theory to a probing gauge field. After that, we can take the band gap to infinity and ask what are the order one terms that should give us the effective response function, which doesn't care about the remote which doesn't care about this band gap. The other approach is that you can say that maybe we don't have to start with a UV Hamiltonian because it's too complicated or there are too many degrees of freedom. Maybe we can just start with the effective Hamiltonian, then couple it to a probing gauge field. But there's one should really be careful about what one means by couple to a probing gauge field. So I'll show you an example which illustrates that if one doesn't think about this very carefully, one can get a wrong result. So, but there's a benchmark. So for band electrons without interaction, we should expect that this effective diamagnetic response should just be like 1 over the effective band mass, the effective mass, which gives the Joule de Witt. Because for free electron, this second term that I mentioned vanishes, so this diamagnetic response gives us Joule de Witt. So as a warm-up, we can think about the following question of multi-band free electron system. So for example, if I give you this Hamiltonian of many bands of electrons with just the kinetic term, then by definition, if we couple the Hamiltonian to a probing gauge field which is uniform, the fermionic fields transform like such. So the momentum gets shifted, but then since there's also a Bloch wave function, so we have to multiply it by the inner product of these two Bloch wave functions. Which is the matrix element of this gauge transformation. So if we start with an effective Hamiltonian, for simplicity, we can consider only one active band at low energy. Then we just replace the kinetic energy with one band. We can do also plug in this following gauge transformation. So, but we find that if we naively do that, this diamagnetic response, which is the term that's proportional to A squared, and it looks like this guy. And if we expand that, this HK bar is the projected Hamiltonian. And if we expand that, there are two terms. One is a Joule de Witt like piece. It's this one, which goes like 1 over effective band mass, effective mass. But there's another piece, which is proportional to the energy itself times this quantum metric. And the the definition of this quantum matrix is not very important to us now, but the problem is that if we start with the full Hamiltonian and do the gauge coupling, we just get the Drude the weight as expected. There's no additional pieces. So why do we get an extra piece proportional to quantum metric in the previous calculation? The problem is that I'll tell you that this actually is a symptom of a violation of unitarity. The problem is that the gauge transformation is not diagonal in the band basis. So an infinitesimal gauge transformation, if you restrict it to the active band, it will look like non-unitary. For example, say if I take the fermion annihilation operator at momentum k, and I do a gauge transformation generated by U alpha, and then I project it to the active band that I start with, I get this form factor, which is overlap between two log wave functions. It's not simply a phase. The amplitude of this guy is actually it's actually not one. It's one plus something else, which is this quantum metric that I mentioned. So that's why if one just start with a projected Hamiltonian and naively do the gauge coupling and project it back, one will get some extra stuff. That's because we mess up with the unitarity. So then the question is that what should one do to like couple the effective theory to a probing gauge field in a proper way?
So just want to make sure, if the band doesn't have a quantum metric, then it's fine.
Yeah, it is fine. So this quantum metric, the integration of this quantum metric over the brilliant zone is related to the spreading of Wannier function. So
for example, if I have a band without any chain number, then the integration over the whole brilliant zone should be zero?
No. It could be non-zero. So there are some relationship between this quantum metric and the Berry curvature. So this quantum metric is lower bounded by Berry curvature. But if the Berry curvature is zero, it doesn't mean that this guy is vanishing.
Do we have any like example?
We have actually many examples of that. I think one can like cook up almost like generic time binding model. So even for a two-band tie binding model, if you try to calculate this guy, it's not in general, it's not vanishing.
Yeah, I'm asking the example with vanishing.
Yeah. For example, if you consider the inter electron in the material, it's very tightly bonded to the atom. So this guy is vanishing actually. So that's why you don't want to. So I think this problem is like this is a very general question, because for every material that we consider, we always only consider the outer shell electrons. We never say anything about the inner ones because they are inert, right? But I think it's because they are tightly bonded to the atom position, so. That's why they don't give you anything. Yeah. At least that's my understanding. Yeah. I don't know if it answers your question. So, sorry. But we can always take a step back and just start from the UV Hamiltonian. So, yeah, we can always start with the UV Hamiltonian and calculate superfluid stiffness. Then ask the question, what we get if we take the band gap goes to infinity? So this task is actually doable because the energies, because there is a perturbative, there is no perturbation per, there's a small parameter in the system, which is the bandwidth over the band gap. So therefore, if we do a perturbative expansion, in terms of that, this expansion is controlled. And the terms that are independent of the band gap should give us the effective diamagnetic and the paramagnetic terms, as I said in the previous slide. So let me just briefly tell you the setup of the calculation and tell you about the results and why should we expect such results. So the setup of the calculation is that we can consider a kinetic energy. For example, so this is a UV Hamiltonian, so this can be any type binding model like a million orbitals, if you like, that doesn't matter to us. And the interaction that we consider is a density-density interaction. So this Hamiltonian can be resolved into its diagonal and off-diagonal pieces. So by diagonal pieces, I mean the projection. So let's say I write the Hamiltonian in terms of these two pieces and a diagonal one and an off-diagonal one. With this projector is a projection operator to the sub-Hilbert space spanned by the many body states with partially occupied active bands and fully occupied of lower bands and fully empty higher energy bands. Then we can do a perturbation theory, which is equivalent, say, we can do a Schiffer-Wolf transformation, that is a unitary transformation which rotate the off-diagonal, which make the off-diagonal pieces zero. So, but let's first think about the following thing. Without coupling to a probing gauge field, this correction to the diagonal piece by this off-diagonal piece is 1/ band gap. So it's a virtual process. We first hop up and then hop back. So it's the energy scale is the Coulomb interaction squared over the band gap. So this correction is suppressed by 1/ band gap. If we take the band gap goes to infinity, this guy is gone. And the effective Hamiltonian is therefore just the original Hamiltonian projected to the sub-Hilbert space that we're interested in. But so now let's consider the Hamiltonian coupled to a gauge field. For a small probing gauge field, we can always expand the Hamiltonian in terms of the powers of A, and then split it to a diagonal piece and an off-diagonal piece. So this unitary transformation, which is the Schiffer-Wolf transformation, is actually, this transformation can be written, this transformation can be written as such with this operator TA, which is just the it's between two states. So for example, so these states belong to different sectors. For example, this M is lives in the sub-Hilbert space that we're interested in, but this n is some other states. Therefore, their energy difference is always lower bounded by band gap. And we also need to multiply it by a matrix element of the off-diagonal Hamiltonian. Why is it different from the case where there's no probing gauge field? The problem is that if we think about it, the current operator can actually be, the current operator is the time derivative of the position operator, so it can be written as the commutator of the Hamiltonian with the position operator. So therefore, this matrix element is actually proportional to the energy difference between these two states. So the matrix element of the current operator between two states that are different in energy is actually proportional to this energy separation itself. And therefore, this Schiffer-Wolf transformation can have pieces have pieces that are independent of delta, because this is proportional to delta and we have a delta suppression. So this piece is actually order one in terms of delta, so that cannot be ignored. So roughly speaking, that's why things are very different if you consider couple this theory even to a very small gauge field. But these are all very straightforward, and we can just do this perturbative expansion and get the effective Hamiltonian, then expand it in terms of the probing gauge field to get the effective current operator and the effective magnetic coupling. So then the current we find that this current operator acquires some correction from the interaction and also this diamagnetic coupling. Note that here, this extra piece is the projected position of commutator between the projected position operator and the interaction. So a similar formula, but for a general momenta Q has been obtained in the quantum Hall literature from this study. And there's another, but we're interested in the A squared term, which is this guy, and it's the proportional to a double commutator of the effective Hamiltonian with the projected position operator. So therefore the average value of this effective diamagnetic term can be written as such. So say we take this effective Hamiltonian and do a unitary transformation generated by the projected position operator. This can also be viewed as a summation of two contributions, which is a naive diamagnetic term. That is, we start from a projected Hamiltonian and do the usual gauge transformation. But we have to add some extra pieces, which is like these two guys. So we can, as a sanity check, we can go back to our simple example of free fermion with one active band. In this case, this guy, which is like this x is a position operator along x direction. This guy is actually proportional to this quantum metric, which cancels the extra piece that I mentioned from this guy and gives us just the Drude weight, as we expected. So, but now we're considering, we can, of course, this is can be applied to an interacting Hamiltonian. So, but yeah, we can get the general formula of this effective diamagnetic term in terms of fermion creation annihilation operators. But for simplicity, we let me just tell you this formula for one active band. So the contribution from the interaction can actually be written as such. The important thing is that this this operator, which I call D, it acts on this form factor, which is the overlap between two block wave functions. This is defined as take a derivative. So this is like moment, I shift the momentum by a little bit, but then I also need to add an extra piece, which is proportional to a Berry connection. So this derivative can also be, you can think of this derivative as a covariant derivative to keep the gauge invariance under this guy. So our low energy theory always have this gauge invariance, which is just the phase ambiguity. And this covariant derivative takes care of this gauge invariant structure.
Is the gauge invariant in the momentum space?
Yeah, this is the momentum space gauge invariance. Right, and then we can go back to more conventional setup and ask when the power substitution holds. So from this expression, if we let the Berry connection goes to zero, this is just like the usual power, this is just a power substitution. If we let these two terms be zero. So this can always be, we can always we can always do that if we consider a trivial band and then choose a gauge such that the Berry connection goes to zero. This gauge choice is actually equivalent to choosing a maximally localized 1-year orbitals. So this is related to the gauge choice of 1-year orbitals. So in this case, we can simply perform the usual power substitution in the tight binding model that we get from the maximally localized 1-year orbitals.
So what if you have a band with fairground topology?
So that's a very good question. So for fragile, actually this is only for a one active band.
Okay.
So for example, in twisted bilayer graphene, when you have you at least need to consider two bands at low energy, and there's a band touching. So in this case, I don't even know whether you can choose a gauge that you have a maximally localized 1-year orbital.
So it seems that from here, the only if we have a band with a trivial chain number, then it's always possible to choose to just the gauge away the Berry connection.
This is simple in the case if you only have one active band. So if you have multiple active bands, then it's more complicated.
So can I do like a non-abelian gauge transformation to shift away the?
I don't know if this can always be done. Right, in this trivial band, one band example, the projected interaction couples to the gauge field actually due to the spreading of the Wannier function. For example, if at low energy you have some, if you start with some density-density interaction and then you project it to the active band, you can get some term that looks like a pair hopping term. And this term actually couples to the external probing gauge field as such. So the intuition is that if we have some spreading of the Wannier orbitals that can actually enhance the coherence between pairs if you form a pair. This is because this pair actually, so this term is actually a pair hopping, but the coefficient of such term is actually this, it actually depends on the spreading of a Wannier function. So if the Wannier function is exponentially localized, there's no such term. So all the pair, if you form pairs, they don't have any hopping. So that's this intuition, but we'll see that it's not a for topological band, this is not the correct intuition. I can give you some further examples. For example, in lowest Landau level, this effective diamagnetic response is zero. This is because the projected position operator commute with the projected Hamiltonian. Why is that? Because in lowest Landau level, the position operator and the momentum operator actually locks. So the momentum conservation will result in the conservation of the dipole, which is the position operator. And this always gives you zero. So, but you might say that if you have a topological band, that means the Wannier, if you want to consider a Wannier basis, then this Wannier function is very non-local. So that should give you some coherence between these Cooper pairs if they form. But this is actually not true for lowest Landau level. So, and one can also consider other examples such as twisted bilayer graphene. And so I would like to say that this formula that we obtained for the diamagnetic term is actually a four fermion term, and then we have to calculate the expectation value. But the problem that we're interested in is a strong interacting problem at low energy. So this calculation cannot be done analytically, but one can always get a bound of that, because the fermion of the expectation value of fermion operators of like fermion bilinear or like four fermion terms are always bounded, because one can only at most have one fermion per orbital. So that will give you a loose bound of the superfluid stiffness. So that's how this plot is obtained. And but surprisingly, the bound that we get for superfluid stiffness is actually enhanced around the magic angle of twisted bilayer graphene. If you're familiar with the literature of twisted bilayer graphene.
The effective K along the level, does that depend on the feeling?
This operator is zero. Because this guy is the you have to calculate the commutator b between the projected position operator and the Hamiltonian, this commutator is zero.
So it's zero for any lambda.
Yeah.
Can we understand why this at magical angle you have an answer?
I think it has to do with some end geometry in this case, because also around this magic angle region, the integrated quantum metric is actually very large. So yeah, I think there are some relationship between that, but it's not explicit. So and also there's a bonus. Sorry, that is called partial F sum rule. So this we can prove that this effective diamagnetic response is also related to the integration of optical spectrum weight. So for temperature that are much smaller than the band gap, we always have this integration of the real parts of the optical conductivity up to some cutoff that's within the band gap. This guy is always equal to the effective diamagnetic response plus some 1/1 band gap corrections. So So in general, there's an F sum rule, which is that if you if you do this integration from zero frequency all the way to infinity, then you get the whole diamagnetic term, which is proportional to the charge density over the effective mass. That just tells you that you have these many degrees of freedom in your system. So here it's the similar thing, but with a partial integration that suppress all the transition between the active band to the remote band.
So why is that a manifestation of a U1 emergent symmetry?
So right, this.
I think here you need, like, for example, to check some gauge invariance under the background gauge information or some word identity. Why is only such a formula can tell you the emergent U1?
Yeah. So this by this emergent U1 symmetry, I just mean that this the particle number of the active bands is conserved. That's the emergent symmetry at low energy.
Why is that conserved? How can I say that it's conserved, the particle number?
Oh, so
that is the particle number?
No. So it goes the opposite way. So because the in the setup of our calculation, we take the band gap goes to infinity, so. And then, therefore, the low energy effective theory actually has this symmetry as the emergent symmetry of the projected Hamiltonian. So as a consequence, one gets such partial F sum rule. So this F sum rule is actually also this is also related to the fact that this effective gauge coupling. So we get this effective theory that couples to the gauge field, right? And then but this coupling can be considered as a unitary transformation of the matter fields. So from that unitarity, one can immediately get these things.
So this implies the unitarity?
Right. But this unitarity also tells us that the particle number is not changed after you do this gauge transformation. If it's not unitary, then actually the particle number changes. Or another way to say it is that the measure of the integral will change.
So here, unitarity strictly equals to gauge invariance of the background.
This gauge invariance is actually more tricky. So yeah, I can say more about it because that's the last slides. So yeah, so in order to say that the so of course the UV theory that we start with is gauge invariant under the physical U1 gauge theory. Is your question that how can we tell if the low energy theory is gauge invariant under this emergent U1 emergent U1 symmetry?
I think if you say there's an emergent U1 symmetry, then you I'm not sure. I think the point is if the low energy theory respects the physical U1 symmetry.
Right. It respects the physical U1 symmetry. But to check but the gauge invariance is more tricky in this case because because we don't, so in this talk, I only talk about when the probing gauge field is uniform. But in general, one can ask what will happen if you couple, so what's the effective theory if you couple it to an like arbitrary gauge field, right? So for that, I think one need to consider the not only the Hamiltonian but the Lagrangian. You know, one has to consider the action. So but still, even if say you even if one restrict oneself to the static gauge transformation, this question of gauge and this gauge structure of the low energy theory is actually very complicated, because this projected position operator, in general they don't commute with each other. The projected x doesn't commute with the projected y, and then if one consider an arbitrary like function in space, then this projection is actually more complicated. And in this case, one question to ask is that now you know how the matter fields transform, but how does the gauge field, how does the vector potential transform under this U1 gauge transformation? This is not, actually one can find that this U1 gauge transformation actually not transform as simply like a U1 gauge field. It's not just like A goes to A plus partial lambda. It's not just like that. One has to consider some, there are other terms. And for lowest Landau level, the question is simpler because the commutator between position x and y gives you a constant. But in general, this commutator is not a constant for like a generic topological band. It gives you the Berry curvature. So in this case, we haven't formulated this theory entirely. Also, this is just like a partial a partial result.
So a very, very naive question. So the projected x operator, the projected position operator, does that depend on the gauge choice of A?
The gauge?
Or is the projected x gauge invariant? Is that a gauge invariant part?
Yeah, this is just a fermion bilinear.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so sorry, that's it, and feel free to.
So we have some time for a couple of questions. Just feel free to answer.
Yeah, I have a very basic question. So in assume we have a topological band. If I understand correctly, then we don't have Wenyan function, right?
You don't have a localized symmetric one-year function.
Okay, then in that case, can you comment on how to define precision operator?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. So you can always write choose a momentum basis such that everything can be defined.
Okay.
In that basis.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I think here it's basis independent because it's just the how you write the the sub Hilbert, how you choose the basis for your sub Hilbert space. So you can either choose a momentum basis or a real space basis, but in this case the expression is much simpler in the momentum basis.
I don't know how is the relation between the basis you just mentioned and the definition of the position operator.
The definition of the position operator is, so if you start from a UV theory, you can always write the position operator as such, and then we do a projection, which is just project these operators to the low energy.
Let's say if I have a band, then the certain chapter is polymetric, so I find it clear, or I can just do this by a general capital space.
Yeah, but for single band, it's simple. But for multiple band, you have to generalize this quantum metric to a multi-band scenario.
Is there such a generalization?
We have this generalization.
And there is that this not then quantum is zero.
Yeah.
And what if you have a dynamical field instead of field?
That's a good question. So here I only consider as a specific gauge field. For dynamical gauge field, things are more complicated because the gauge transformation of the, for example, this matter field, so it goes like, it goes like something like this guy, and where the, I can, for example, I can consider a probe gauge field, and this is, so, but in general, this will be a, this guy is a, like a function in space. If we consider static gauge transformation, then one has to do this projection at the end. But in lower Solana level, this is simpler, I think, because the position operator to the nth power and then project it, and I think it's related to you first do the projection and take the nth power with some extra pieces, but I think they are like and of simple form. For example, if it's just this guy, this is just some constant that depends on the magnetic length. So this can be written explicitly for lower Solana level, and right. But then this transformation is actually very funny, because if you want to ask, okay, what's the gate transformation for this guy, in order such that the theory is gate invariant, this the gate transformation for that guy is not simple. Yeah, I think it looks like the gate transformation of this guy looks like as if you do for lower Solana level, I think at least it can be related to the volume preserving diffeomorphism. So if you do a volume preserving diffeomorphism and then ask what it looks like for this guy, and it's something like that. But in general, I don't have a formalism for addressing that question.
I think I'm not sure. So my understanding is that the problem is, is strictly equal to, if you can find a completion, UA completion of a single band, in which the U1 symmetry is still implemented in an outside manner.
Yeah, this is not, in general, this is not possible, right?
Yes, for long, it's not possible, but I think, I don't know what's the additional information contained in the quantum metric. If the, for example, like if the chain number is zero, what prevents you from doing that? Trivial chain number can always find a UE completion such that the U1 global symmetry is implemented still as an on-site symmetry. So you can just add lingual arrival and engage it.
Well, it should be careful about things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also this quantum metric actually tells you the minimal spreading of the linear function, and there's actually no upper bound for that. So even if you start with a trivial band, the spreading of the linear function can be large. So in this case, I don't know if the gate transformation can be implemented locally.
So is the linear function gauge dependent or gauge independent?
The minimal spreading is gauge independent, but the minimal spreading is determined by the quantum metric, which is also gauge independent.
Okay, so the quantum metric and the minimal spreading are all gauge invariant quantity.
Right.
Oh, sorry, this is a little basic, but is there a nice way to see the, like, sort of geometrically see the connection between the quantum metric and the Berry curvature on topological bands or anything?
Yeah, so the quantum metric, so I can write tensor called quantum geometric tensor for a single band as such. So the diagonal part of that is is quantum metric. Then and the imaginary part of the off diagonal piece is related to Barry curvature, and then one can prove the lower bound of the quantum metric related to Barry curvature by considering some specific combination of this term and like just using some manipulation of inequalities and stuff.
So the meaning is that even for a single U1 symmetry, the possible anomaly is more than the spectral flow or a chain number. Right.
That's what I guess, but I don't know how to like address. I feel like this is kind of, this can be addressed in terms of anomaly, but I don't have a very concrete formalism for that.
So it's no question, let's thank Dan again.